Into the Hanukkah story, and that is the story you did not learn in Hebrew school. This is the unrated, straightforward version of what actually happened. And this is something that I've spent a lot of time doing research on, because this is also not exactly the story that I was shared when I was growing up. Because the Hanukkah story is actually a much more complicated and dark story. A little more complicated than they tried to kill us. We survived. Let's eat. even though that's kind of the way we celebrate it, if you think about it. So that's why you're coming to this class, because, they tried to kill us, we survived, let's eat. You know, that's unfortunately been our history. So we got another one of these holidays. I mean, what do we need another one for? So is this just to make us feel better while all of our Christian brothers and sisters are enjoying Christmas? So we'll have something, you know, we'll have the dreidels, and they have their lights, we have our lights. You know, is that what it's about as well? So obviously it's a little deeper than that. And that's really what I want to spend a little time with you this evening. Now, when did the Hanukkah story happen? And this is the real deal. This is not some apocryphal myth, fable that we read to our children in the dead of the winter to brighten up their lives a little. Anybody know when did this take place? Anybody know? You don't have to give me a year, but like, give me a little benchmark in Jewish history. Did this take place in the course of the Bible, like in the times of Moses, Abraham? What's that?
Post-biblical.
Okay, this did not happen, just to give you a little sense, any time around the times of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, Moses, David, Aaron, and Solomon. Did it happen shortly thereafter those great personalities lived?
No.
It did not happen shortly thereafter either, which is why there's really no mention of this story, of this celebration, anywhere in the Bible. It is a rabbinically instituted holiday, because it took place after the close of the Bible. Okay, where did this take place? Where was the story of Hanukkah? What's that? Okay, it took place actually during the Second Temple era. So I want to do a little background. Okay, the first temple was built by whom? Anybody know who built the first temple? That was actually recorded in the prophets, not in the five books, but after the five books you have the prophets. That was built by anyone else? King Solomon. Good. Shlomo HaMelech. That temple lasted for approximately 410 years. What happened to that temple? Why isn't it still around? It was destroyed by whom? Anybody know? Not by the Romans. The first temple, but I'm glad you said that, so we're going to clarify. The Babylonians. Nebuchadnezzar was the king of Babel. He was the greatest superpower at the time. And they destroyed the Jewish temple built by Solomon, which lasted for 410 years. Existed in Jerusalem, of course, on the Temple Mount. Same place where we have the wall, which surrounds that mountain. And that was in the year 586 BCE, any students of history here. Now, when I hear numbers like that, they actually do absolutely nothing for me. But if it didn't happen like 1990, you know, right, it's not helpful. But 586 BCE. What happened to the Jewish community at 586 BCE when the first temple was destroyed by the Babylonians? The survivors of that terrible destruction of Jews that were living in Israel, most of the Jewish community, almost all Jews lived in Israel at that time. What happened to them? What's that? They were exiled into Babylon. Babylonia. Okay? That exile did not last very long. Anybody know how long that exile lasted? Only 70 years. Until the Jewish people were allowed to come back to Israel under the new, more tolerant Persian Empire, which defeated the Babylonians. You're not going to be tested on all this, but you're going to get a little basics. The Babylonians were toppled by the Persians. The Persians, under Darius, allowed the Jews to come back to Israel. To give you a little benchmark in Jewish history, Jewish holidays, what other post-biblical, rabbinically instituted holiday is celebrated around that time, when the Jews came back to Israel to rebuild their temple? Post-biblical, Yom Kippur is mentioned in the Bible. The Purim holiday. Okay, the Purim holiday, which we're going to reference later on. Talk a little difference. There's differences between Purim and Chanukah, because they're really bookmark holidays. The Jewish people rebuild their temple under the new Persian Empire. And while they're living, everything is doing, seems to be doing okay. It's under the Persians that we get threatened by Ahasuerus and Haman and Purim. We survive that. And who topples the Persian Empire eventually? Who's the next big superpower? By the way, if you study Jewish history, you'll learn world history. Okay? Who? Before the Romans. The Greeks. Okay? You can say this is Greek to me. But the Greeks were the next ones in line. Now the Greeks is really what the Hanukkah holiday is all about. Okay? And we're going to get into that in a minute. Everybody here heard of Alexander the Great? Probably the greatest conqueror who ever lived. Alexander the Great had a vast empire. He was actually a friend to the Jews. There's some wonderful stories mentioned in the Talmud between Alexander the Great and some famous rabbinic figures. He was very young when he was killed in battle. He was also a bit of a philosopher.
He didn't die in battle.
What's that?
He didn't die in battle. He died of disease.
Oh, thank you. Really? And how old is he? Do you guys know? 33.
30 and a half.
Oh my gosh. That's unbelievable. Thank you. So, what happened to Greece after Alexander the Great? Now, the reason I'm sharing all this is because it's very pertinent and relevant so you can get the real Hanukkah story. Okay? What happened to Greece? It was essentially broken up into amongst Alexander's three top generals and divided his kingdom into three different parts. The part that's relevant for us is referred to as the Greek-Syrian Seleucid Empire. The Greek-Syrian Seleucid Empire. They essentially had control over the areas referred to very liberally as Syria, under which Judea, the land of Israel, fell. The Syrian prince, or the head of this one part of Alexander's vast empire, was called, and he's the bad guy in the story. What's he called? He's like the Haman, if you will, of the Hanukkah story. His name was Antiochus. In fact, the Syrian Greek capital was called Antioch. They were kind of filled with themselves, the old Greek. They named their capitals after their emperors or their kings. And he was actually a very ambitious individual. He hoped to expand Greek culture throughout the territories that he ruled over. His personality was known to have been quite unstable, exhibiting at times extreme cruelty at times and extreme generosity at other times. He was a bit of a Meshuggah kind of guy. He was the one that also introduced the what became later the barbaric Roman gladiator games. He was known to leave his throne at banquets to dance in the nude with some of the entertainers. He was a very colorful personality. He was no lover of Jews. Now, what he really loved more than he perhaps hated Jews, and that's really the point of the class, actually, was this thing called Hellenism. Hellenism was the Greek ideology. And don't get this confused with Plato and Aristotle and Socrates and the great Greek philosophers we all studied in college. We got nothing against them. What we're talking about now, when we talk about Hellenism and Greek ideology, we're talking about essentially paganism, worshipping idols and celebrating and worshipping the physical. You've all heard of the Greek god Zeus and Hercules, and they were these incredible figurines all over Greece that people would worship, literally because they worshipped the body. And that is why the games, the famous, we celebrate them today, we don't know where it came from, the Olympic Games, and all that were originally played in the nude. The body was celebrated as the ultimate type of deity, if you will. Now, of course, this fell into complete contradiction with Judaism, which believes in a what? In a God that you can't even see. Right? We subscribe to a God that is completely non-physical, and we say that the most important things in life are specifically what? The things you can't see in life. So, well, we say it's important to live healthily and to eat properly, which is why we have oil-soaked latkes every Hanukkah. We say it's important to do all those things, but that's just because the body houses the soul. There was no belief in the soul. What you see is what you get in the Greek ideology. And Antiochus was very adamant about unifying the various ethnicities and minority groups and different ideologies that all fell within his vast empire, all under this one ideology called Hellenism. Now, even before Antiochus started forcing Hellenism down the throats of the Jewish community, there were many Jews that were sucked into it on their own. And that's the other part of the story that you perhaps were never made aware of. I know I wasn't. And there were some pretty nasty things starting to happen within the Jewish community. Jews who were essentially abandoning their own Judaism in favor of this new ideology that really worshipped the physical. And that, as I mentioned, is referred to as Hellenism. I'll give you one little sense of this. In those days when you had a temple, who was the most important figure in the Jewish community during the temple times? Right? The priest and the high priest. The Kohen Gadol was considered the most important religious Jewish personality. At one point, the Kohen Gadol, which was essentially passed down from generation to generation, his name was Chanyo. And he was clearly the rightful Kohen. Chanyo had a brother who became a Hellenized Jew. And this was very much taking root in the Jewish community. He changed his name. It was referred to as Jason. There weren't too many Jewish kids being named Jason by their parents at that time. But he was, as I mentioned, Hellenized. And he offered a huge bribe to depose his own brother so that he himself could be appointed the new Kohen Gadol. Now, you can't be appointed Kohen Gadol. You don't run for Kohen Gadolship and put up signs and give, you know, speeches and all that. You simply... it's the background music. You simply... don't worry about it. It's fine. You simply are a Kohen Gadol because your father was, and you are the son that merits it because you are a big scholar and very pious and dedicated.
It wasn't to the eldest?
It was, usually. Okay. Now, the thing is that with Jason, he didn't want to become the Kohen Gadol because he wanted to become this very pious religious figure. He wanted to bring his Hellenism right into the mainstream, right into the temple, by having the most important religious figure in the Jewish community be a Hellenist. So he offered Antiochus a huge bribe, lots and lots of money, to depose his own brother and appoint him Kohen Gadol. He also promised the king Antiochus even more money, another additional 150 talents of silver, if he would authorize the building of a gymnasium for the youth of Jerusalem, and if he would consider the people of Jerusalem, the Jews, honorary citizens of Antioch, which was the Syrian Greek capital. The king agreed to it. The king was interested in Hellenizing the Jews anyway. How much better if there are Jews themselves who believe in this and can spread it amongst their own people. Jason built a gymnasium close to the temple and continued the practices of the Greeks, pagan customs and values, to such an extent that the Kohanim, the young priests in the temple, began to neglect the temple service in favor of Jason's new gymnasium. Now when I say... you'll hear. Now, when I say gymnasium, there's nothing wrong. We all belong to gyms and go to the... Gymnasiums were places, really, of almost idol worship. There were offerings and sacrifices offered up to the Greek gods. The games were played in the nude, once again celebrating the physical. And there were Jewish boys in these gymnasiums disguising themselves, covering up their circumcisions, not to get too graphic, so that they could fit in and that they could be seen like everybody else. Now, where am I getting all this information from? I probably should have started by sharing this. None of this is mentioned anywhere in the Jewish writings. It's not in the Talmud anywhere. It's not in the writings of Maimonides. This information comes from a very important and famous Jewish historian. He was a very controversial figure in his own right, Josephus Flavius, who himself, according to some, was a Hellenized Jew. And and it's written up in the Book of Maccabees, which is part of the apocryphal literature. Never made it into the canonized Bible. But if anybody wants to do more reading, there's a lot of information and history about this particular time. So you know what? Let me just tell the whole story. Let me tell the whole story, and then we'll take questions and discussion after, if it's okay. 3 years pass, and the time comes for Jason to pay off the king for the building of this gymnasium. In 171 BCE, Jason is removed from office by Antiochus, and he's replaced by another Hellenized Jew, a bigger crook, by the name of Millenius. All nice Jewish boys. Most Jewish mothers would not name their children Millenius and Lysimius and Jason. These were Hellenized Jews taking on new names. Antiochus, who was once Millenius, who was once an emissary of Jason, then used his position to undermine Jason so he could become the new Kohen Gadol. I mean, it was a farce. You don't become the new Kohen Gadol. And you had Hellenized Jews fighting amongst each other to curry favor with Antiochus. In order to pay off this huge debt that was now owed to Antiochus after all these years, Millenius and his brother Lysimius, who acted as his deputy, took the gold vessels from the Jewish temple, sold them to raise money to give to Antiochus. And when Chonio, the real and authentic Kohen Gadol, protested, they had him killed. And this is what was going on in the Jewish community. The priesthood was completely corrupted. A growing opposition now started developing within the rabbinic and sort of mainstream Jewish community to Millenius and Lysimius. Among the Jews of Jerusalem, they arose in revolt, and they actually began fighting, and there was infighting between Jews and Jews. You understand, many of these Greeks were Jewish themselves, who had adopted this new Hellenistic form upon themselves. And of course they were aligning themselves with the Greeks themselves, these Hellenized Jews. Those who revolted sent emissaries to Antiochus demanding the removal of Millenius, but he was able to flatter and bribe Antiochus enough. But ultimately Antiochus put Millenius to death. There was all sorts of backstabbing and paranoia going on. Jason then tries to seize this opportunity to get back into the game and to rid Millenius and to restore himself as the high priest. He organizes an army and attacks Jerusalem, capturing it from Millenius' army. Now, don't worry if you don't get all the details. You're getting the point. But Millenius and his forces escaped to Acre, which is a military fortress. Antiochus then begins to view the struggle between the Hellenized Jews and the Jews who are maintaining the traditional classic Judaism as a rebellion against him. And he ultimately invades Judea, capturing Jerusalem, killing tens of thousands of innocents. According to Josephus, approximately 40,000 Jewish people were killed. This was like a real story. This is like a really bad situation. And it was at that point that Antiochus begins his systematic attempt to eradicate Judaism. And I say Judaism because he was not really out to eradicate Jews. He was really out to Hellenize them. He entered the temple, the Jewish temple, pillaged the vessels and gold, forcibly really reinstated Millenius as the high priest. Antiochus was not satisfied that Millenius was loyal enough to de-Judaize, if you will, the Jews. And so in 167 BCE, he dispatches his general Apollinus together with an army of 22,000 foot soldiers to Jerusalem. And again, they go into the city and they massacre innocent Jews. The Acre fortress is placed under permanent Syrian control. The Syrian Greek Syrians breach the temple walls in 13 different places, forbidding the Jews to repair the breaches. Greek temples and altars are set up all over ancient Judea, and a decree was passed. More music. And a decree was passed that required pigs to be used in sacrifices, even in the sacrifices that were now being brought to the Greek gods in the Jewish temple. The Jewish temple, okay, which had just been rebuilt, not just, but was rebuilt, was now converted essentially into a pagan temple. And there were altars all over Israel. And if you were a Jew, you were forced, you were not permitted to publicly practice religion. If you were caught privately practicing your religion, circumcising your sons, studying Torah, observing any of the holidays, it was under penalty of death. And not only that, but Jews were required to offer sacrifices to these pagan gods upon these altars that were set up all over Israel, including in the temple itself.
This is later then, right?
I'm not great with dates. This is significant. Well, this is about 200 years before the Roman period.
This is all BC, isn't it?
Yes.
Quran is later, which
later. Much later, but
the Quran is later, but the beginning of okay, so this is earlier. Let me just get through the story. All of this happened. Who's the famous hero, if you will? Yehuda HaMaccabee, good. Judah the Maccabee. There was an elderly man, actually. His name was Matityahu, the son of Yochanan, who was the Kohen Gadol, the previous Kohen Gadol high priest. You'll hear in a minute. This is Matityahu. Matityahu lives in a Judean village near Jerusalem. He refuses to sacrifice to the idol that was set up in that town. And he publicly kills a man who was about to slaughter a pig on a Jewish altar. And he declares publicly, whoever is zealous for the Torah and is steadfast in the covenant, let him follow me. And his five sons, one of whom is Judah the Maccabee, his five sons essentially rescue their father and they flee to the mountains in the Judean desert. Many other loyal Jews followed his example. Approximately 6,000 loyal Jews gather under Matityahu's banner and they begin to rebel, essentially striking back in the night raids and retreating back into the Judean hills where they were observing Judaism to whatever degree was possible. The five sons of Matityahu were Shimon, Judah, Elazar, Yochanan, and Yonatan. The father told him to follow the advice of Shimon. He was supposed to be the wisest, but to look to Judah the Maccabee for leadership in battle. Apollonius, who I mentioned earlier, was a Greek general that was hired by Antiochus to lead the Judean campaign, gathered soldiers to attack Judah and his forces, his rebels. But Judah was forewarned. They struck in advance, killing Apollonius and much of the Greek armies. He was a very, he was an incredible warrior and strategist. And he took their arms. Siron, who's the commander of the Syrian army, heard about all this, figured he could make a great name for himself by putting down the revolt, gathers a well-equipped army, marches into Judea, and again is foiled by Judah and his forces. And this is going on. It just keeps building. And every time the Jewish rebels are successful, the Greeks send a larger and more imposing force. Lysia, who was now given the task, he was a very prominent general in the Greek army, is now given the task to head the Judean campaign. He appoints three of Greece's greatest generals, Ptolemy, Silon P, Nicanor, and Gorgias, to lead the Judean campaign, puts him in charge of an army of 40,000 soldiers, foot soldiers, 7,000 cavalry. They have these war elephants, sort of like the ancient equivalent to tanks, and they're marching into Judea, and this is a very famous war that was fought was a speech that Judah the Maccabee was supposed to have given that was very inspirational, that charged up his forces. Just to give you a little sense, the Greeks were so confident that the Syrians that they would win, that Nicanor, one of the three generals, summoned Gentile slave dealers from the coastal cities and promised them Jewish slaves at unprecedented low prices because they were just going to wipe them out once and for all. That was going to be the end of it. The Syrian army encamped near the town of Emmaus, E-M-M-A-U-S, which is actually very interesting because it's right near Latrun. Latrun was, in 1948, Ben-Gurion, with the Haganah, tried to take Latrun from the Jordanians, were unsuccessful in 1967, were successful, and it was in a very important part of the both War of Independence, Melchemet HaShechrur in 48, and the Six-Day War in 1967. And it was there where this battle took place between the ancient Greeks and our ancestors. And Judah gathers his forces at Mitzpah. Mitzpah is the biblical site of the home and the grave of the prophet Samuel, just 12 miles from Emmaus, what I just mentioned. And with some amazing courage and some military deception, Yehuda outmaneuvers the far larger Syrian army. He splits up his own forces, placing each battalion under the leadership of one of his brothers. He forces the Syrians to divide and then destroys its smaller components, killing thousands and forcing the survivors to flee back north to Syria. That was essentially the last of any large Greek-Syrian force to ever occupy Judea. And the revolt was incredibly successful, and it goes down in history as the only minority ethnicity under the vast Greek Syrian under the vast Greek Empire to ever repel the Greeks from their midst. And what was the last part of the story that I know all of us are familiar with? Because that's what they told us in Hebrew school. Immediately upon victory, Judah and his forces, the first thing they do, they go to the temple. And what are they looking for when they get to the temple? First of all, what do they find in the temple? They find idols, and they find it's just been desecrated. But there's a mitzvah that's supposed to be performed every day in the Jewish temple, and that is the mitzvah to light the menorah. And you need oil, of course, to light the menorah. They find oil, but only enough. Only one flask, which would be enough for a day, right? And it would take them a couple of days to replenish and get new oil. But somehow, miraculously, it lasted for 8 days, giving the Jews enough time to basically create their own new pure olive oil to be able to keep this mitzvah alive and to essentially reinstate and rededicate. That's really what Hanukkah means. Chanukah means dedication. Because that's what the Maccabees did. The first thing they did is they went into the temple and they dedicated it. The word Chanukah actually is a breakup of two smaller words. Chanu Kaf He. They rested on the 25th. Kaf is 20. He is 5. 25th. It was the 25th day of Kislev that they finally could put their swords down and they finished their battles. So on one hand it means they stopped fighting, but it also means they dedicated. Because they weren't simply fighting for survival. Because I want to ask you a question. By show of hands here, how many of us are familiar, maybe with a little, but with most of what I just shared in the last 15, 20 minutes? 4, 5, that's actually 6. All the details of these wars with Nicanor and Gorgias, Ptolemy, and all the battles and this, that, and the other. Okay, you were. Now, it's interesting, I have to tell you something. I went to 12 years of day school, and I didn't see Rabbi Ezra's hand go up either. Which is good. No.
I was being honest.
No. Which is good, because it only proves the point. Why is it that we don't know this? And I didn't know this before I started doing a little history. Because when you study and you go to Jewish schools, and I went to 12 years of day school and all my years of going to yeshiva and then rabbinical school, never talk about this stuff. They only talk about what the Talmud mentions. And what does the Talmud mention? You have it right before you. Take a look at the handout. Follow me. The handout right, it says Talmud, page 21b. What is the reason of Chanukah? Right in the middle of the page. It's a quote from the Talmud. For our rabbis taught on the 25th of Kislev, commence the days of Hanukkah, which are eight, on which a lamentation for the dead and fasting are forbidden. All right, why do we have Hanukkah? Because the 25th of Kislev, there are these 8 days, and during these 8 days, if someone God forbid passes away, at the funeral, you shouldn't give what's called a eulogy, because even though it's a sad thing, no matter how you slice it, you're supposed to diminish the sadness a little, because it's such a happy time, by not having a eulogy, and you're not supposed to fast during this period of time also. Why? For when the Greeks entered the temple, they defiled all of the oils, therein, and when the Hasmonite dynasty, that's the Maccabees, prevailed against and defeated them, they made search and found only one cruse of oil, which lay with the seal of the high priest, but which contained sufficient for one day's lighting only. Yet a miracle was wrought, and they lit the lamp therewith for 8 days. The following year, these days were appointed a festival with a recital of Hallel and Thanksgiving. So why is there no mention of what we spoke about? And I'm telling you, that's everything that the Talmud says essentially about the history of the Hanukkah story. Nothing about Georgius, Ptolemy, and Nicanor. Nothing about Judah and his forces. Nothing about all of these incredible military outmaneuvering of the vastly, outnumbered, soldiers that the Greek Syrians had. Isn't that something you'd be proud of learning about in Hebrew school? Isn't that something we'd want to know about? We've been kicked around for so long. This is the Jews coming back, So wouldn't we want to be equipped with all the details and know all this? Why? And what, the rabbis didn't know this? The rabbis who wrote the Talmud lived very shortly afterwards, maybe within a 200-year period afterwards. So they knew at least of what we just shared with each other. Why wouldn't they have included this? So I want to share an idea with you. And then we can open it up for conversation. And it really goes to how we began our class tonight. What are we really celebrating? Because what would have been, and this is just my theory, what do you think would have happened if the Talmud had all the stories that I just shared with it? How would our celebration be different? Because the only thing we really know about is the little tail end of the story. Like, after they prevailed, they walked into the temple, only found one cruse of oil, and somehow it lasted miraculously for 8 days. That's like telling like a story about this whole thing, and you leave out the first, 90% of it, and you give like the little tail end, 10%. You missed like the whole thing. Or not. What is really being celebrated? And what I think the rabbis wanted us to understand by conspicuously leaving it absent from the Talmudic tradition and from our writings and the rabbinic literature is not to get too bogged down on the military victory. Why? Why shouldn't we get bogged down on the military victory? It's something we should be proud of. And I think, this is just a suggestion, I'd like to hear what you have to say as well. And that is, we'll misunderstand what this whole fight was about. Because the truth is, it didn't really even have to be a battle. You see, there are two different types of anti-Semites that we've contended with in our history. Those who've tried to destroy us physically, and those who have tried to destroy us spiritually. Can anybody tell me what Hanukkah really is celebrating? Physical or spiritual? It really is spiritual, because if you think about it, not one Jew had to die. Not one ounce of blood needed to be spilled. Because if the Jews would have simply become good Greek Hellenists, there wouldn't have been a reason for a war. There wouldn't have been a war. And in fact, that's what some of our own people wanted to happen. Just abandon your Torah and your ideology and all of these, and just get with the game, guys. That's what's sweeping the ancient Near East. It's Hellenism. That's what's in. Go for it. And the fact that there was a war, we brought the war on ourselves. Now, I believe for very good reason. But there didn't have to be a war. If you wanted to prevent bloodshed, all you had to do, you didn't even have to convert. You just had to abandon Judaism and be a Hellenist. Now, that's very different than the other holiday I referenced earlier. What's the other holiday I mentioned earlier? Purim. Because Haman is much like Hitler in that if a Jew in Germany would have stood up after the Nazi racial laws of Nuremberg started to be applied to the Jews of Germany and stood up and said, and said to Eichmann and said to Himmler and said to Hitler and to the Gestapo, we are willing to abandon our Judaism and we will follow in the German Aryan ways. Would it have mattered? He didn't care. It didn't matter to Haman and it didn't matter to Hitler. They were trying to destroy us physically. But it did matter to Antiochus. Antiochus was not initially setting out to destroy Jews. What he was trying to destroy was Judaism. Now, if he couldn't do it without destroying Jews, then so be it. But that was our choice. And perhaps, the reason the rabbis left out these magnificent stories about our incredible courage and heroism of the ancient Maccabees, who took on the Greek Empire, the Greeks, Alexander the Great's descendants, is so that we today in 2009, when celebrating Hanukkah, can understand what this holiday is about, because the lesson of Hanukkah from 2,000 years ago is the same lesson today. It's the same thing that's going on in the Jewish community today. No one's putting a gun to our heads. And no one is saying, you better abandon your Judaism or else. But it's the same issue that we're confronted with in our own even more open and progressive society. Which is what? Okay. Which is, help me out here, Rabbi Ezra. What was I saying? In our own society, which is essentially to what?
Assimilation,
thank you. And there's an amazing holiday, and I want to read an article with you in just a few minutes, written by a phenomenal writer, because it's so ironic that so many more Jews celebrate Hanukkah than do Purim. And let's be perfectly honest why this is the case.
Christmas.
And Purim? I'm saying today, why are there so many more Jews? No studies have been conducted, but I can tell you. Okay? There are a lot more Jewish people celebrating Hanukkah than Purim. And that has to do more with being integrated into the society we're in than it has anything else. And Purim?
No.
Purim, they tell you to get drunk. What could be bad? Right. No, I'm saying Hanukkah compared to Purim. That's it. Purim, that's not part of the holiday of Purim. I'm not talking about Tanya Desteh, which is the fast that comes before. Take a look, if you can, at the handout. Take a look, please, at the handout. It's a wonderful article I want to read with you. Okay, take a look. It says 119. Has anybody ever heard of Hermann Wolk, by the way? The Winds of War. An amazing Jew who wrote a phenomenal book called This Is My God. And if you got this book, listen to what he has to say here. I think this is missing a page. In 1,000 years of national existence on the soil of Palestine, the Jews over and over drove out oppressors and regained independence. But the Maccabean War, a battle for religious liberty, alone found a place in the rites of our faith. It stood out. It was the Jews' first full-scale encounter with the question that was to haunt them in the next 2,000 years, namely, can a small people dwelling in a triumphant major culture take part in the general life and yet hold on to its identity, or must it be absorbed into the ranks and the ways of the majority? That question is such an important and pressing question for our community today. It's the same question that the Jews, our ancestors, had 2,000 years ago. Could they live in a society where everybody was getting into Hellenism and still maintain themselves as identified proud Jews? Or would they have to give it up and just become like everybody else? In the two great worlds of current affairs, the communist empire, which so much resembles an ancient military dictatorship, and the tolerant, skeptical free West, they face the question again. He wrote this in the 50s when the Cold War was still raging. The communist position of the Jews is generally, though with less crudity, that of Antiochus. Our religion, the Soviets consider, a barbarous relic, superseded in wisdom and soundness by Marxism. The training of children in this exploded Semitic superstition goes against good sense and the interests of the state. So the police discourage such teaching in ways sometimes oblique and sometimes forcible. For Greek religion substitute Marxism, and the Russian Jews are back where their fathers were in 168 BCE, with whatever differences one may find in the relative truth and beauty of the Greek and communist cultures. The next part really is more pertinent to us. Last paragraph, I'm sorry guys. The challenge of the West is different, though just as serious. The proposition is the old one, that the Jews are confronted with a better way of life and should give up their religion for it. Forces that are not coercive and therefore do not call forth a human impulse to fight them urge Jews along this path. The position of the government, and indeed the deep conviction of most American leaders, is that the Jewish community has the right to hold fast to the faith of its fathers and ought to do so. What contradicts them, turn the page, is the tidal force that Di Tocqueville long ago marked as the great weakness of a democracy in his unforgettable phrase, the tyranny of the majority. The pressure to emulate neighbors, right? So peer pressure. The urge to conform to popular views and manners, the deep fear of being different. These in the United States are the forces of Antiochus. Listen to the next line. Where the power of the sword long ago failed, the power of suggestion has recently been doing rather better. Now what is he saying? He's saying essentially that the same struggle that our ancestors had to confront in the days of the Maccabees, which is a sweeping ideology where everybody's doing a certain thing, is the same issue our community has to contend with today. It would be pleasant to believe that the stabbing relevance of Hanukkah to Jewish life in America has occasioned the swell of interest in the holiday. But a different and perfectly obvious cause is at work. By a total accident of timing, this minor Hebrew celebration falls close in the calendar year to a great holy day of the Christian faith. This coincidence has all but created a new Hanukkah. It was entirely natural for a new Jewish generation growing up in the United States to feel each December like children in the dark outside a house where there was a gay party, pressing their noses wistfully against the windows. That Judaism had its own rich and varied occasions of gaiety was beside the point. Most second-generation Jews were but poorly trained in their own faith. He's really speaking about our parents and grandparents. He wrote in the 1950s, when, as he writes, very in an autobiographical sense, kids felt jealous. They felt cheated. They grew up in New York City. You walk around, every time you see a tree, you see a menorah. It's not so tough here anymore. But imagine what it was like not too long ago, even here in New York City. And anyway, the Christians had a brilliant midwinter feast, and the Jews did not. Some families solved the problem. You understand what the problem was. You raise your kid in a Christian America, and everybody's doing this thing, and it's awesome, and it's beautiful, and it's great, and you're like, what do we have? So some families solved the problem in the simplest way by introducing Christmas trees, Christmas presents, Christmas carols into their homes. They argued that it was harmful for their children to feel underprivileged, and that the Christmas tree was a mere pleasant ornament of the season without religious content. Meantime, in schools there were large numbers of Jewish children. Where there were large numbers of Jewish children, you had a dual celebration of Christmas and Hanukkah, which sprang up. Just on the ninth floor of this building is a wonderful school. It's called the Smith School. And I was in the elevator with the principal of the Smith School, and she asked if I could come by. We were talking about this, to come by and do something for a Hanukkah celebration for the Jewish kids in the school. It's like 30-40% Jewish. As an official symbol of mutual courtesy and tolerance, this in turn generated a new Jewish interest in Hanukkah. even those Jews who were celebrating Christmas, by the way, this is how Hanukkah became popular in America for Jews, because Purim isn't. And they're really identical types of holidays. They're both post-biblical, rabbinically instituted holidays. Doesn't really make sense that one would be much more popular than the other. This is how Hanukkah became popular. Even those Jews who were celebrating Christmas in their homes, trees, holly, born as the King of Israel and all, began to find it seemly to add an electric menorah for their windows, and perhaps even to light the candles. This apparently solved the problem by giving the children the best of both worlds. The aggrandizement of Hanukkah itself is a fortunate accident. The level of knowledge of all of Judaism must rise when any part of it happens, for whatever reason, to gain attention. Right? He's saying, okay, it didn't happen for the best of reasons. It would have been a nicer thing if Jews celebrated Hanukkah because of everything we talked about so far, and not simply because it fell out at a time when everyone's doing something else. He says, but so what? The son of my skeptical friend is not likely to stop after learning about Hanukkah. A lack of clear and satisfying religious identity hurts American Jews most in December. This is why the apparently trifling issue of the Christmas tree generates such obduracy and such resentment. Top of the last page. It rasps an exposed nerve. It's a good thing that Hanukkah is then at hand. If the old custom of Hanukkah money has become the new custom of Hanukkah gifts, that is a minor shift in manners. The tale of the Feast of Lights, with its all-too-sharp comment on our life nowadays, is very colorful. It is of the greatest use in giving the young a quick grasp of the Jewish historic situation. The gifts win their attention, the little candles stimulate their questions. The observance seems tool to the needs of self-discovery. Listen to the last paragraph. Our whole history is a fantastic legend of a single day's supply of oil lasting 8 days, of a flaming bush that is not consumed, of a national life that in the logic of events should have flickered and gone out long ago, still burning on. That is the tale we tell our children in the long nights of December, when we kindle the little lights while the great Christian feast blazes around us with its jeweled trees and familiar music. The two festivals have one real point of contact. Had Antiochus succeeded in obliterating Jewry a century and a half before the birth of Jesus, there would have been no Christmas. The Feast of Nativity rests on the victory of Hanukkah. There's a lot of power in these words, for many reasons. First and foremost, I share this with you because it's so ironic that what's gotten us to celebrate Hanukkah is our, to a large degree, assimilation in the broader culture, which is really what Hanukkah is celebrating, the fact that we somehow maintain our identity and did not assimilate into what everyone else was thinking, saying, and doing. Think about that for a minute. It's only because we are so part and parcel of American society, which is essentially a Christian society, that we have been, I don't want to say forced, but that has motivated us to look at Hanukkah. So now we're looking at it. But what lessons are we taking from it? If we only have, if it's all about the military, and the rabbis put in all of these details that we talked about earlier about the military victory and Judah the Maccabee, and we would just look at it, we survived again. But that's not what we're celebrating. That's not Purim. What we're celebrating is the fact that a different ideology was sweeping the ancient Near East 2,000 years ago, and lots of our people were beginning to adopt it instead of Judaism, abandoning Judaism in favor of Hellenism. The question is, today, will we do that again? Or can somehow we learn to live in peace with our non-Jewish brothers and sisters, learn to appreciate the beautiful culture around us, but understand that first and foremost, we are Jews, and we have our own ideology. We have our own special way of thinking and of living. If we can do that, and Hanukkah can remind us of that lesson, then this will be the most important holiday, as far as I'm concerned, on the Jewish calendar. If we can take that lesson away from this holiday, because that's really why the war was fought. There didn't have to be a war. Nobody had to fight. We could have simply, very nicely, been absorbed into Greek Hellenistic culture, and there wouldn't have been any more Jews, and you and I would not be sitting here today eating latkes and lighting any menorahs. There wouldn't have been any of us anymore. At the time, it wouldn't have seemed so terrible. Just like today, it doesn't seem so awful either when we become part and parcel of the society around us. What's wrong? Everything is beautiful. It's great. But little by little, we're becoming smaller and smaller, and there are less and less of us, because what keeps us as a people is our Torah and our mitzvot. And when we begin to leave that, then we have nothing left, at least of our people. And this is an incredibly powerful lesson that we didn't study in Hebrew school, because nobody wants to hear this story when you're 10 years old, or 15, or even 20, or even 30, or 40. Because this is not a fun story. And this is a very contemporary one that I think we all need to think about. And maybe things are a little different, honestly, because Hellenism really contradicted Judaism. And there's so many wonderful things in our society that don't necessarily contradict Judaism. And maybe we can adopt that with Torah, and I believe that to a large degree. But there are clearly things out there that are simply, you know, inappropriate for us to adopt into our lifestyles and to try to morph with our lives in as Jews. And we have to be able to tell the difference. And when we can tell the difference, then we can know that this is something I can embrace, this is something I need to stay away from, this is something that I can synthesize with my life as a Jew. I can take the best of Western culture, right? But I don't adopt another religion, and I don't abandon mine, especially when we live in a country that allows us all of the political freedoms to follow. That's the founding fathers came here to practice their own religion, because in England you had to subscribe to a particular version, okay, of Christianity, and you had to live in a certain way. And we live in a country, and it's just so ironic that we live in such freedom, and yet we've just little by little sort of given it up. And maybe. That's why we really needed Christmas. To almost force us to look at Hanukkah, to learn this very, very lesson for our own generation. I can go on and on and on, but I want to hear what you guys have to say just about any of this. Questions or comments? Please. Yeah.
Sir, my name is Yosef Matabiado. I see a lot of connection between the story of Yosef and Joseph's Falls during Hanukkah and the Hanukkah story. Obviously, there's a lot in terms of who Yosef was, and all, but do the commentators mention any connection between the two?
Yeah,
is there supposed to be a connection when the holiday falls on a parsha? Is there an inherent connection with that generally, specifically as a play?
Right, so the parshiyot, the Torah portions that we read always around Hanukkah, revolve around Joseph. Joseph, the biblical personality. So what is the connection? It's so obvious. Who was Joseph? Joseph was a nice Jewish boy raised by his father Jacob, who, by a crazy turn of events, ends up as a big shot in Egypt. Right? Where, by the way, what did they do in Egypt? Who did they believe in Egypt? They worshipped
sun.
Right? They worshipped the sun, they worshipped the this, they worshipped that, they worshipped the Pharaoh. He worked for Pharaoh. He was number two, the vice president of Egypt. He saved Egypt from, and he was, and we also believe he did not give up his Jewish faith and his traditions that he had learned and studied by his father Jacob. And he's really the model. He's the Hanukkah Jew, Joseph. So, I mean, I didn't see this anywhere, but it's so, to me, it's just so obvious that, you know, we read those Torah portions around Hanukkah time, I think, so that we shouldn't say, I shouldn't have anything to do with the rest of society. Joseph contributed tremendously to the rest of society, but he also maintained himself as a Jew. He was able to do both.
So is comparing the parsha to the holiday something generally throughout the year that we should and can't look at?
We always do. And a lot of sermons and ink has been spilled, you know, trying to show the connection between the Torah portion read on Shabbat and the holiday that's falling out during that period of time. And I think Joseph and Hanukkah, they go very much hand in hand. Absolutely. Yes?
I have a question. Do you think that Yom Kippur, in a similar light, is sort of like Americanized in that Jews in America feel like if they keep that one holiday that they're Jewish, and that like that helps Yom Kippur and helps people Jewish?
I don't know. I mean, it's almost bad PR, because if you or I were to think of one holiday,
it would be Shabbat, I think.
Well, it comes out every week, so I don't know if everyone's going to go for that. But you know, it's just fun. I always say this on Yom Kippur that it's sad in a sense. You know, obviously, Yom Kippur is the holiest day of the year, and I think our people know it, and that's why everybody comes. I don't think anyone believes to be a good Jew, all you need to do is show up once a year. I think most people acknowledge that to be a good Jew, you need to come regularly and to have a real relationship. But at least I'll come on Yom Kippur, I think people believe. But it's bad PR, because if you want to pick one holiday, you want to pick something that's going to bring people back for other times. And a holiday that requires you to fast all day and pray all day and chop and shmop, and I did this bad and I did that bad, it's not a great, you know, PR holiday. I'm all in favor of Yom Kippur, and it is the holiest day of the year. But you don't get a real balanced sense of Judaism by simply observing that one day. I don't know if it's an American thing. I think it's just become the minimum kind of, I've got to do something to acknowledge my Jewishness. So what will it say about me if I don't show up to temple or synagogue on the holiest day of the year, on Yom Kippur? You know, but I think it's an interesting phenomenon that you're pointing out, that we have this... But it's not about Americanism, I have to tell you, I don't think. It's just about whatever generation we happen to be living in. Because every single generation of Jews had to deal with this issue. Are we going to assimilate, or are we going to remain identified? And here's the opportunity we have. This is the first generation where we could actually do both successfully. I spoke about an individual that Rabbi Ezra knows from his community this past Shabbat, and he's one of many, many such individuals who make sure that he's at daily prayer services every morning. He dons his tefillin, he wears a kippah, he studies Talmud every day, and wherever he goes, he's eating kosher food. And he is one of the leading, if not the top leading researcher from the United States on AIDS. And one of the top people at the CDC, the Center for Disease Control, he's not so terribly unique. You can go to some of the best law firms and see, you know, many of its top partners living the lives of Torah observance. You can go to some of the best hospitals and see some of the best doctors of our generation, you know, wearing kippot, or women who are observant, Torah observant. You can go into any field and find that. We live in a society that allows us to really be serious about our religion and really be out there and part of the world. It's successful and integrated and be able to contribute something. We have that opportunity, and I feel sometimes we're so used to like having to choose. You know, I think our grandparents probably had to choose. They said, if you don't show up for work on Saturday, don't bother coming on Monday. That's what a lot of our grandparents heard.
That still happens in the United States and hospitals.
It's illegal.
That happens in hospitals.
Well, hospitals are a little different, because hospitals are the nature of the work. But it is also the case that that Judaism believes in the preservation of human life so much that for a physician who has to work on Shabbat is not really considered a contradiction. It's really the exception. But if you're ever in a position where they do not make accommodations, I mean, and this is recent. My father always tells me this story, that when he was in law school, his Jewish professor for contracts, he approached him and he said that the holiday of Shavuot is one of my contracts examples. So he said, well, you know, it's not Yom Kippur, so you have to take it. And my father said, well, I have to observe the holiday. We're not permitted to write, we're not permitted to do all these things. And there was no accommodation. That was it. He had to repeat the course the next year. And it's like, if anybody went to law school, you know, you take contracts for a year and you take one test, that's it. Today, forget it. You can take that professor to court, and we live in a very, very different world, even over the last 30, 40 years. There was an attorney here who who appeared before the Supreme Court, is actually a religious observant Jew, Nathan Lewin, to give the right for American soldiers to wear a kippah. They actually had a little camouflage kippah that they had developed for Jewish soldiers in the army. I mean, this country is so accommodating to your religious beliefs, it's unbelievable. In jail, forget about in freedom. Okay, even in jail, you request kosher food, you get kosher food. We don't live in that, but I think the mentality is, this is what I want to open this up for discussion, that like, no, you know, it'll hold me back, they're going to look at me differently. You know, being different is in. It's cool to be strange in America. That's really, you know, America embraces diversity. And somehow, you know, the Jews have become known for, sticking up for everybody else's diversity except our own. You know, and we don't. There are no fights to be had. You know, any other comments?
Rabbi, I remember a few years ago, the cover of New York Magazine, it was cool to be Jewish again. They had this, like, I see the rabbi was sitting in a funny pose, or it was like, it's cool to be Jewish. It was all Kabbalah and, you know, Jewish mysticism. Do you remember that?
It was
the cover of New York Magazine.
Right. I mean, I guess you're speaking about the popular culture. I'm even just saying, like, in a technical legal sense. You know, but you're absolutely correct. And it's not just in New York. Obviously, New York's easier because there's more of us. So there's more familiarity and the like. Yeah. Since the close of the actual... Right, so the Torah has 24 books in it, all the way from the book of Genesis to all the way through the five books of Moses, the prophets, and the writings. What year? Over 3,000 years, but, right? Anywhere between 3,000 and 3,500 years, I would say. I'm sorry, I'm not great with the dates. Yes?
There is
several
songs dedicated to Baruch Yochai.
To who?
He's a rabbi who was also doing the temple construction.
Rav Shimon Bar Yochai was a great Talmudic sage. He lived later. He lived during the Roman period. And he was actually, they attribute the writing of the Zohar, the writings of Kabbalah, to Rav Shimon Bar Yochai. Now, during later, just so you have, who came after the Greeks, guys? So actually, Maimonides says that the Greek story, or this whole Hanukkah story, resulted in the Jewish people having political freedom and religious freedom for another 200 years until who came along and took it from us with the temple? The Romans. Okay, so Rav Shimon Bar Yochai lived later, during the Roman period.
Can he be compared to the
Rav Shimon Bar Yochai, I wouldn't say was involved in the military revolt like Judah the Maccabee was, but he was. He certainly rebelled against the Romans, who forbade also the study of Torah. And he took off with his students into the hills to study Torah on his own. So he's similar in that sense. It's a good point. Yeah.
I think Rabbi Akiva would be the arms bearer for Bar Kokhba.
Bar Kokhba.
I was going to say, just a quick, cool comment. Good friend of MJ, Michael Steinhardt, donated to the Israel Museum there for the dedication ceremony, a stela found in a cave in Israel, which is a large stone relief inscribed in Greek that predated Josephus, obviously, and discussed, it was a Greek letter to the local Greek council saying, start oppressing the Jews, don't let them have their religious freedom. It's actually the
story,
proof of this story. It's absolutely amazing. You can see it in the Israel Museum today. Another question. You mentioned Purim and Hanukkah. Purim, when all the Jews were threatened, we didn't fight, we prayed. And only after we were saved did we know.
No, there was fights, there were battles.
Only afterwards. Only after we won, and the decree came out that Jews.
After the decree came out,
we're going to go fight.
Right.
But the solution was to pray, was to fast 3 days, and that's where redemption came from.
That's true.
So why there? What do we learn from there? We pray, but in Hanukkah we fight. That's the first part. Second part of the question is,
I mean, they also fought. I mean, let me just stop you before, because you're right, there's more of a battle waged here. There was a rebellion, just very, very different. You know, the whole Greek thing, you can't even compare it. The Jews are living as a minority group amongst the 127 provinces of ancient Persia. They're essentially sitting ducks. The Greeks, the Jews are living as a politically independent sovereign state when the Greeks start doing this to them. Okay, now, did they have an army? Did they have but they had political sovereignty. So I think the compare is different. It might simply have fought here because they had the wherewithal to do so, whereas it's like saying the Jews in Eastern Europe before the Second World War, why didn't they fight the Nazis? You know what I'm saying? Like, Poland fell, you know, to the Nazis. Countries, governments fell to the Nazis. There were no armies of Jews in Germany or in Poland or in Switzerland, you know. So I think that's more similar to the way the Jews lived in ancient Persia, as opposed to the Hanukkah story where we had our own country. And by the way, that's why Hanukkah and what's happening in Israel today is also very, a lot of great similarities there of reinstating political sovereignty.
Second part of the question was, the majority of Jews, I believe, stayed in Babylon after Ezra.
That's correct.
Back. Were they affected by this? The same way in the Purim story, all the Jews were affected throughout the provinces.
This is much later. This is later. The Second Temple stood for at least 200 years before the Greeks came in, and so this is centuries later. I don't know how many Jews were still in the diaspora. There were clearly significant numbers of Jews in the diaspora outside of Israel. Most of the Jewish
community. Most Jews were in Babylon.
No, most Jews were in Israel. Most Jews during the Hanukkah story were in Israel at the time. Most Jews remained in Babylon when they had the opportunity to come back to Israel and rebuild the Second Temple.
But by then, yes.
So, but I don't really know enough. I'll tell you, if anyone wants to do some studying on Jewish history, I'm not a historian, as you can hear, but I read a lot. There's a great book, there's a great author, and it's very user-friendly. It's not written in an overly academic way, but it is very solidly academically based, and that is the writings of Rabbi Beryl Wein, W-E-I-N. We'll put it in the bibliography. He wrote these three books on Jewish history. And they're not easy reads, but they're not hard to read through. And he puts it over in a very interesting way. And they're like coffee table books. You can get them. We'll put them in the bibliography. And it fills in a lot of the, you know, but I'm telling you, you study history, especially Jewish history, you have such a sense of what's going on today. Because very little new ever happens. It all repeats itself. It's amazing. It all repeats itself. And if we can get a little sense of how we dealt with this same issue 2,000 years ago, and by celebrating Hanukkah. So let's just finish up now, because I don't want to keep you guys here all night. So how do we celebrate? No, that's Purim. We eat oily foods. There's no such obligation, although it's fun. We spin drills, eat oily foods, and but what is the mitzvah? The mitzvah is to light the menorah. And that's why, by the way, how do we celebrate the holiday of Purim? Is there any menorah to be lit? Is there any candles that you light on Purim? No. What do you do to celebrate Purim? You eat a big meal, and you drink, and you party. It's a very hearty party kind of experience, because what are you celebrating? What kind of freedom? Physical survival of the Jewish people, that we survive physically. So how do we celebrate it? By eating and getting, like, you get your body into it. Hanukkah, what are we really celebrating? Spiritual, and that's how we celebrate. We celebrate what we're celebrating, which is by how? What is spiritual? By lighting a candle. When you light a candle represents the light of Judaism, and that's why the candle, the menorah, has to be placed where? Where do you put your menorah?
In the window.
Now, let's say your window, let's say you don't, well, hopefully everyone has some window in their home, but where do you put the, let's say your window faces a brick wall. You have a beautiful view of your abutting buildings, brick walls,
the doorway
in this beautiful town. So, first of all, you could still technically put it there, but really it's supposed to be what? What is the whole point of putting it in a window?
It's
supposed to be seen by other people. So if there's no one going to be passing by there, it would probably be better to put it... So some say that you can open up your door. You gotta think this is weird now. Open up your door and you put it opposite your mezuzah. Okay, and you can put it there. This way people in the door, in the hallway, will kind of see it. If you think that's going to freak out your neighbors or going to kick you out of the building for being a pyromaniac or whatever it is, then you can just put it in your home. And as long as there's someone else coming into your home, we hold that it's called in Hebrew persume nisa, which means publication of the miracle. So just publicize it. Get it out there. And this is different than Shabbat candles. We had a class about Shabbat, because what's the point of Shabbat candles? Is to create light in the home, to really enjoy and benefit from the light. That's not the menorah. The menorah is a purely symbolic candle. You light it to remind people of the miracle that occurred, that there was only enough cruise oil for one day, lasted for eight, but really the survival of the Jewish religion, the spiritual survival of the Jewish people. That's really what you're doing. So you're not supposed to use it to light up your home. You're supposed to put it somewhere so people can see it and spread it around. That's really the point of lighting the menorah. How do we light it? The first night we light... Okay, well the shamash is... Who said the shamash? Where does that come from? Shamash right here is the leader. Here you got your menorah. We have an extra menorah, do we?
You can buy one around the corner.
Everything's a business, right? So here, you got your... this is your menorah. You light the other candles with the shamash. You don't even have to technically put the shamash back in. The most important thing is that it's clear to people passing by that what night of the holiday it is. We light the first night one candle, the second night we light two candles, the third night we light three candles, and so on and so forth. Anybody know the blessings? Ezra, did we have that?
Do
we have that sheet? You saw that one sheet? You know what we will do? We're going to send you guys. Maybe we can send it?
Here it is.
We have here just a little sheet with the blessings, both in English and in Hebrew, and transliterated. First you make the blessing. Actually, three blessings the first night. First is over the candle itself. It's not in your packet. The second blessing is over the miracle. Sha'asa nisim. Nisim is miracles. Allah avotena bayimim hem bezman hazeh. And then on the first night only, you have a third blessing, the blessing of Shechiyanu renewal. So you make the three brachot the first night, or on subsequent nights, two blessings. And then you light your candle, or two candles, or three candles. And there's, of course, the ma'us tzur. You buy each other gifts. Have a great time, and have a wonderful, wonderful Hanukkah experience. Any questions just about the menorah, and about how to celebrate this? Yeah, Hadassah. Okay, good. Anybody know when you have to light Shabbat candles? What would you say? You light the menorah first. Why? Tell us, Sloan.
Once you light Shabbat.
Good. Once you light Shabbat candles, you've brought in the Sabbath, and then you can't really light your menorah then. So you always light the... Now, anybody else know the difference between, let's say, lighting on Friday and the rest of the week? Also is a little different in the sense that candle needs to last long. Usually a candle just needs to last about 30 minutes. And most of the candles you get in those boxes last 30 minutes. But on Friday, you need to use a thicker candle. I suggest people simply, it doesn't have to be as thick as this, but just use a regular Shabbat candle on your menorah. And if it doesn't fit in, just kind of get it in there. And the reason we do that is because we light Shabbat candles before sunset. Right? And since we light candles before sunset, the menorah candle, the Chanukiah, is supposed to be lit 30 minutes into sundown. Okay? So therefore it needs to last a little longer. So on Friday, make sure your menorah candle is thicker, so but lasts a little longer, that's all.
Do you have to use a Shabbos meal to light your menorah?
No.
You still strike a flame after Shabbos?
No, you don't. First you light the menorah, and then you light the Shabbat candle. That way you're not, because you're not really permitted to light and strike a match after Shabbat. That's the point. Right, or move fire around, that's correct. Any other questions? Hanukkah queries? Yes?
Is Hanukkah just as significant a holiday in other countries?
Probably not. Probably not. Yeah, I mean, in other Christian countries, for sure. I would imagine in Rome and, you know, in Italy. But it's actually more popular than... The difference between the popularity of Purim and Hanukkah is much more distinct in America, let's put it that way. And it has a lot to do with the falling out with the calendar, the way things come about, which I think is very interesting.
So which holidays are more popular in countries where... Yeah, countries that were...
Middle East countries? I don't know, that's... I'm not really sure. You know? You mean... Well, Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, I think, are universally more... But I have to tell you, you know, this goes back to what you said before, there's really no difference. It's not as though there's an underline or a highlight over the words Yom Kippur in the Bible than there is over some other holidays. A lot of this is just sociology. It's just how they developed somehow. And that's why in certain Middle Eastern or North African countries where Jews have lived, you know, they will be observing Shavuot and Sukkot and holidays that many American Jews never observe at all here. Because they take them just as seriously as Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur. We're very much affected just by, you know, as I say, not just theology, but also sociology. You know, just sort of what happens. I don't know. I'm not sure what's more or less popular.
Yeah. You raised the question earlier during the lecture. There was a reason why, particularly, they don't give a Western version, so to say, Western civilization version of the destruction of the first temple and the destruction of the Hanukkah. You give a reason why the schools, like, you know, the Shiloh, so to say, the Western civilization version of the whole situation.
Because classically in the yeshiva they're studying Talmud, and the Talmud doesn't really have much of these stories, but it does have a lot of stories about the destruction of the first and second temples. The question I raised this evening is, how come there's so little in there about the Hanukkah story? All it talks about is the cruise of oil. This little, you know, thing of oil. What about all the military battles? So the theory I was advancing is that they leave it out purposely so that we don't mistake this holiday.
What happened to the Ahasuerus, to the Esther?
There's a whole tractate of Talmud on Megill, on the story of Purim. Yeah. Yes, Rabbi Ezra.
There's two specific places where the story of Hanukkah is written in our lore. One is in the Talmud, and it specifically speaks about there the miracle of the oil. It doesn't at all mention the battle, and that's what we spoke about. But interestingly, the prayer that we recite Hanukkah, something that you'd add in the first half of the meal, or something that you'd say in your silent devotion when you pray, all that mentions is the miracle of the battle. See, there were two miracles. There's the miracle of the fight and the miracle of the light. So the question is, I guess, why is it that the Talmud's recording it, all we speak about is the light, and when we're praying about it, in the Great Sacraments and in silent devotion, do we only report the battle? So...